produced by Jeffrey Griselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, V.R. Hoisington and Wayne Hall. This is Yes Music Podcast, episode 384. What did they do next? Part 2B, Tony Kaye.
This is Bill Bruford, the ever-enthusiastic young drummer from the group Yes, and you're listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 384 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host, Mark Anthony Kaye, will be along a little bit later on. Please do get involved with the podcast yourself, which you can do via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. This week's episode contains setlist spoilers for the upcoming Royal Affair tour. If you don't want to hear those, then feel free to come back and listen later on. Mark and I have been listening to One Live Badger this week, so that we're ready to share our thoughts with you. Listen out for that in a few moments. We also felt it was important to discuss two major pieces of Yes news in our two pence section: an announcement from Yes management and that setlist spoiler from Alan White. On the YMP Facebook page this week, Daniel Crone and Keith Hoisington spotted an interview with Alan White, which is well worth reading, and it's there that the setlist spoiler was given away. Alan seems to be the freest of the group with this kind of information, which is interesting. Mark and I will come back to the Yes management news later, but essentially it's about a new Yes box set of very early recordings, which is being put together right now, and for which they're appealing for fans' own items. So up you go into the loft and sort through those cardboard boxes you've been meaning to get to for decades. Brady Queen, Daniel Crone and others mentioned this to me. The Drummer's Journal has a great video interview with Dr. Bill Bruford, which is an excerpt from their much more extensive piece, and Vaughan Hossman posted a wonderful photo of Peter Banks, Oliver Wakeman and Steve Hackett at the CRS Awards in 1999. Now there's a lineup. Preston Frazier showed off his vinyl copy of One Live Badger, which he likes a lot, and Billy Sherwood posted a selfie from the Yes Asia rehearsals. Preston also reviewed From the Balcony from Open Your Eyes, and he's glad it's on that album, even if it breaks no new ground. Alan White displayed his new Royal Affair bass drum head, which looks fabulous in Roger Dean's inimitable style, and also a shot of himself looking relaxed, leaning on a Mini Cooper after rehearsals. In the visitor posts, Barry Gorski received his Patreon Book Club bookmarks, and Zach Evans added a video game YouTube video from 1994, which has some music on it which sounds rather familiar. Adrian Bell plays some 1,000 Hands on his show, and Tony Handley spotted a Forgotten Yesterdays post about an article from Billboard.com on, weirdly, Chris Squire's Run with the Fox. Patrick Gannon gives his selection for the upcoming tour, and Mike X. Hanratty shared an upsetting report on Peter Max, who did the cover for Talk. Unfortunately, he's no longer able to paint due to dementia. There's a lot of fascinating information on the show notes for the first part of our look at One Live Badger, so do get along there to read what Brady Queen, Doug Curran, Guy de Rome, Ken Fuller and Michael Pratt had to say. Miguel Falcao's Play for Chris 5 project has an extended deadline, which gives me a bit longer to practice. It's now the 15th of June. The company behind the YMP t-shirts, T Public, tell me that they're running a sale. June the 19th to the 23rd, you'll be able to get 35% off. So take a look at that if you like via the YMP Emporium link on yesmusicpodcast.com. Many thanks to Michael Pratt, Cliff Brand and James Carter for recent emails, and of course many thanks to everyone who got in touch in any way this week.
Olá, sou o Miguel Falcão, de Coimbra, Portugal. Estão a ouvir o Yes Music Podcast.
Before Mark and my opinions on One Live Badger, Bob Martellotta has sent us his, and here he is.
Hey guys, it's Bob Martellotta from Atlanta, and I am giving you my thoughts on One Live Badger. Thanks for pointing this out, guys. I knew that this was out there, but for whatever reason, it was never on my radar. And I'm a guy that's got quite a substantial collection of Yes solo work, so I'm surprised I never had this before. But I think Mark was spot on. This definitely has a Southern rock vibe. Being from Atlanta, you hear a lot of this music down here, and by no means is it what I would call progressive rock, but I think Mark mentioned both the Allman Brothers and the band, although the band I know is not really Southern rock, but I can definitely hear hints of both of those. I think the Allman Brothers was a really good comparison, but it was very entertaining. You know, again, it was something a little bit different. Tony's, you know, work on the Hammond is great as always. You know, it was really good. And I enjoyed the vocalist. I very good musicianship. It just blows me away that the trivia that you guys pointed out, that this recording was recorded at the same venue and the same show as Yes Song. So really a crazy piece of trivia. But all things considered, you know, not normally in my wheelhouse, but it was certainly entertaining. So I'm really glad you guys pointed it out. A fun listen. I'm not sure that I would give this a whole lot of repeat listens, but if you're in the mood for some good old crank down the windows and crank up the tunes kind of music, I think it would fit the bill. So thanks, guys. That's my 2 cents, and keep up the good work. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks very much indeed for that, Bob. It's fun to compare your opinions with ours. My initial reaction to Wheel of Fortune, the first song on the album, is wow. It's funky, groovy, a bit bluesy, particularly in the lead vocals, but with a rock sensibility. You can easily hear Tony Kaye's wonderful Hammond organ tones, but the approach is different to his Yes work. He takes one of the massive, memorable funky hooks and makes it his own, while the harmony vocals are superb, and there's a bit of variation in tempo and feel which keep it all really interesting. Guitar solos are great if a little bit sunk into the mix, and the bass line is agile, wide-ranging, and again, funky in approach. Later on, the guitar soloing takes us on an extended working through the material, which sounds semi-improvised, as Kaye provides the glue, sticking it all together. Drums are assured and precise, but still manage to groove with the music. I'm delighted to experience a bass solo as well. It's not a Chris Squire solo, but even so, for this time, the instrument is... But even so, for this time in the music, the instrument is highlighted, even if it's playing a fairly simple pattern repeatedly. There's a bit of a proggy explorative feel for a time, and then we get back to the massive groove. 7 minutes and 50 seconds of highly enjoyable and accomplished songwriting and performance, which keeps you nodding your head throughout. It's topped off with a brilliant Tony Kaye Hammond solo, one of the most energetic of his I've ever heard, which spirals around the bass line to make an intricate pattern. It's also exciting to hear Tony shifting the tonality and rocking out here. He's clearly enjoying himself before the chorus reappears. Considering this is live, it sounds fabulous, a superb opening to the album. I'm not sure if the crowd were mic'd up properly because their reaction is a bit muted, which is a surprise, but perhaps that's better than adding fake cheers in. Nobody in their right mind would do that on a live album now, would they? The second song is enigmatically entitled Fountain. It sounds as if the recording just continues from the end of the first song, which gives it an attractive live experience feel. However, this song opens with some 70s synth, rather than Hammond, which is then introduced after a few moments. It's highly engaging. This is very laid-back music with easygoing vocals almost lazily added above an almost horizontal groove. It has echoes of Barclay James Harvest for me, combined maybe with Wishbone Ash. Kaye again provides the basis for the song on the Hammond, which does appear to continue under the synth soloing. How was that achieved? Mike Dunn, who I had an email conversation with shortly before he died, is named as Technician Tapes, so I wonder if he added some additional sounds into the mix. There's an extensive guitar solo which meanders its way through the scene attractively, and the harmony vocals are indeed, as Mark suggested in our previous chat, very American sounding, which doesn't make them any worse. As I hear more of the synth and Hammond combo, I'm even more intrigued by it. There's a full-blown synth solo now, presumably from Kaye, which makes significant use of a pitch wheel and elaborate florid runs, not something really ever heard from Kaye in Yes. It leans more towards shades of Wakeman and Mraz's note-bending antics. It's fascinating to listen to and opens up a different side of Kaye for me, probably because I haven't listened to enough of his post-Yes work. If not a very memorable number, it's still very tight and well-performed, with its kickback and relax feel lasting for around 7 minutes, like the first song on the album. It's a satisfying contrast at this point. Next we have Wind of Change, another interesting title. This one begins with the same combination of proggy synth and Hammond. It has an attractive walking pace feel with some great storytelling vocals, set against a rhythm section playing a jaunty, rocky riff. It's an unusual chorus with plenty of those harmony vocals again. The main riff is wonderfully catchy, and this is another song you can't help but nod your head to. The lyrics are quite enjoyably psychedelic, talking about a man who is chained like a dog to a lead, but it seems to escape. Maybe due to the wind of change or something like that. Anyway, that huge guitar-driven hook piles in again before a great rock and rolling guitar solo, which ends in that insistent riff again. Kay gets to solo again on his trademark Hammond, and again, I'm interested to see how different this is to his role in Yes. This is a full-blown, long and intricate solo, which shows off his amazing ability. I can't help but feel he was constrained in Yes. Clearly they weren't interested in this side of Kay's playing, and it wouldn't have suited the Yes aesthetic at all, but feels like he's been set free here to fly in his own way, on that wind of change afforded to him by Badger. Well, with the next song, River, they're keeping their enigmatic song titles going. This one is pure rock and roll, a jumpy song, but with some complexity in the vocals, time signatures and arrangement, and some contrasting textures which elevate it beyond the bands you might think this sounds a bit like. Pure rock hero guitar soloing lifts the spirit, and I'm sure this one rocked the house at the Rainbow. There's lovely undulating K keyboard work and a definite deep purple slant to some of the lead vocals. Lyrics talk about there being a river between you and me, and the tightness of the band is once again a treat. I Wanna Get Across becomes a sing-along repeated refrain which I assume the crowd were happy to join in with, before more top-notch rock electric guitar soloing. K is a little less obvious in this song, but that doesn't make it any less enjoyable. A great party number with a proper bang and bash, rock ending. The last two songs on the album were particularly approved of by Mark, so here we go with The Preacher and On the Way Home. The Preacher starts with some great harmonies between keys, guitar and bass. The bluesy vocals tell us a tale of a preacher, and the general feel is quite Age of Aquarius, but maybe with a bit of a harder edge than some of the other music of the time, which followed similar themes. There's gutsy, rocky lead guitar and lovely Hammond sounds backing up the powerful and soulful vocals. Another immersive song. It combines some gospel-type harmonies and approaches with remarkable rock sensibilities. For me, it could have been extended, but I like it as it is. So finally, we find ourselves On the Way Home. This has the biggest and baddest rock riff of the collection, and some almost Jeff Beck or Gary Moore guitar soloing. The lead vocals are strong, but there's an American-influenced, tuneful and pleasing harmony chorus. Similar to the previous song, this one has sacred themes, and really couldn't be much further away from Yes if it tried. That's not a criticism, I like it a lot. The juxtaposition of the rock riff and the melodic vocals is interesting and attractive. It's almost like Deep Purple have mashed up one of their songs with a Journey number. The music then makes a gear shift up in tempo and turns into a passionate expression all about being on the way to heaven, which, with the gospel influence backing singers and Hammond organ, transports the listener to a hall, perhaps, somewhere in the US. Kay pulls out all the metaphorical stops again to deliver a scintillating Hammond solo, and the song and the album ends with a fantastic playout which rises and threatens to explode with energy. There's a short a cappella section and a definite, carefully crafted ending, after which the crowd have been convinced to raise the roof in appreciation of this remarkable live event. Just imagine experiencing this adrenaline-fueled performance and then welcoming Yes onto the stage in 1973.
Greetings, friends. So this week, Kevin and I are going to be taking a more in-depth look at the album from the band Badger entitled One Live. Because we already took a look at the Flash debut record, this is the reason why we're taking a look at the Badger album in the What Did They Do After series, since we already kind of took a look at that record with Tony. So this is going to be our look at one of the other records that Tony did after leaving Yes. So one of the things I decided to do when approaching this time, as you know, last week's episode featured a few of my reviews of various records, one of them being, I believe, One Live from Badger. Rather than listen to it and hear what I thought of the record, and believe me, I was curious to listen back to it because I don't really remember offhand what I said on there word for word, obviously. I thought it might be wise to just leave it and approach this fresh, which I did. I went down, pulled out my record again, listened to it for the last 3 or 4 days, and, you know, give my thoughts on what I think of it based on a fresh listen. What's interesting is that I really love this album, first of all. And there was a time earlier on in my life that I really, really loved live albums. In fact, I only bought live albums for a long period there. I wasn't very much interested in studio records, which I find kind of interesting now in retrospect because I seem to make so many of them on my own. And I seem to just love buying them because I love listening to studio records now far more than live records. But back then, I was really into it. And I'm sure if I would have stumbled across this record back then, it would have been high on my list because this album has a fantastic live feel to it. It's one of those records that you refer to as a headphone record. When you put it on, turn down the lights and listen to it and just get immersed in the music. Now, one thing that I find very telling about this record is how Tony Kaye performs on this album. To me, when I listen to this record, it sounds like he's absolutely in his element. Now, I love the Flash record as well, but the one thing that I've kind of found with that record is there were moments in it that I kind of got the feeling that he wasn't 100% comfortable with. I mean, number one, he's using a synthesizer, something that he totally despised and was one of the reasons why he left Yes to begin with. And because he was hired as a session player for Flash, I guess he kind of just did it to appease the people that he was recording with. But, you know, also there was a lot more progressive tendencies and long stretched out things on there that were reminiscent of more Yes type songs. But this album and the songs on it are very much opposite to that. They're a lot more bluesier, more American straight rock. As I mentioned before, there's a lot of bands that they kind of reminds me of, Allman Brothers, The Band. Also bands like Traffic come to mind, or even Blind Faith, for example, is a great example of what they were probably trying to match up with. You know, just that kind of American rock, like a lot of Crosby, Stills, and Nash and stuff like that in there. And that also depends more on just straight up improvising, you know. And I know progressive music has a lot of improvising in it, but this is just a lot more free form stuff. No crazy, you know, time signatures or, you know, no, you know, syncing up the drums and bass. And then, you know, the keyboard player doing something in another time signature, and then the guitar player doing something in another time signature. This is just very much more not so thought out. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean that it's more playing from the hip or playing from the gut, so to speak. Every song on this record, I find, is very catchy. It's really one of those records, again, that I think benefits from a quiet listen to. Now, the opening track, Wheel of Fortune, for example, is fantastic. And the guitar player in this band, Brian Parrish, does a fantastic job of playing guitar and singing. And there's quite a few songs on here that he does actually sing. He sings Wheel of Fortune, he sings The Preacher, and he sings On the Way Home. In fact, I'll go on record to say that the last two songs on this record, The Preacher and On the Way Home, are probably my favorite songs on this record. And the funny thing is, when I did some research on reviews of this record, a lot of people who did a review of this album before didn't think that those were the strongest songs, which I found interesting, because I thought that they really stood out. They had a great feel to it. I think the singing was very heartfelt. You can actually believe that what he was singing, he was kind of singing from the heart, and it just really had a fantastic live feel to it. The other songs on the album were all good too. I mean, Wind of Change is good, and that's sung by David Foster, as well as The Fountain, or just Fountain. And it's incredible that they perform these songs so well in a live environment, because there's no studio album before this where they could have, you know, referred to and, you know, practiced the way they did it in the studio and performed it live. This is just performances of the songs that they've written and just performed them straight on stage. And that's kind of rare, I think. I don't know of too many bands that just did a straight-up live album as their debut. Now, of course, we also mentioned before that Roger Dean has an involvement with this album as well, being responsible for the artwork, and we all know that he's done many of the Yes albums, so of course there's that connection there. I really think that Roger Dean's art captures a sort of interesting feeling when you look at it. I mean, I've always been one of these guys that likes checking out the album covers while I'm listening to the records, and I wouldn't say that this music has a wintry feel to it by any stretch, but there's just something about the album cover that seems to suit the music. I'm not sure really what it is. I can't imagine this album having a different album cover than what it does. And one last thing that I want to just say that I'm kind of curious about is that John Anderson has a co-production credit on this record. We did mention in the prior episode that the recording of this album was done at the Rainbow Theater while they opened for Yes. And I believe that it was the same show that they used for the Yes Songs album, or at least parts of the Yes Song album. So I'm wondering what John Anderson's involvement is in this, because to be quite honest, this kind of music doesn't seem like the type of music John Anderson would be too interested in, I don't think. I mean, he seemed very much interested in the sort of progressive, very structured and thought out and really long, expansive pieces. And this is far from that. This is, like I said before, very free form, almost like they did a lot of this stuff by, you know, eye signals and, you know, little gestures, you know, okay, here comes the next part, you know, an eyebrow raise and we're into the pre-chorus sort of thing. I really wonder what John Anderson's involvement with this record is. And if anybody out there in the YMP universe knows what his involvement was, I'd really love to hear it. Okay, those are my thoughts on Badgers One Live. And now let's get over to Kevin, and I'm sure we'll discuss this further.
So there are our thoughts on One Live Badger, and Mark is here with me now. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How you doing?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Yes, so I really enjoyed One Live Badger. And I was fascinated to hear that you started off with your record collection only buying live albums. But but this is a very different kind of live album. And as you say, I couldn't agree more. It's a headphone record, as you put it, and an absolutely fantastic sound for a live album. And I was wondering how the decision might have gone. Did they plan to always release this, to record this show and release it as an album? Or maybe they decided to release it afterwards when they found that the recording was so good.
Yeah, I mean, either one seems like a logical explanation. I've always kind of had the idea or thought that maybe because, for whatever reason, maybe scheduling from the record label, maybe they wanted to get something out ASAP.
Yeah.
And that once they heard how good the recording was, right, of the show, then maybe they figured, hey, you know, this sounds good enough to put out, let's put this out.
Yeah, well, I'm very glad that they did, because it's really enjoyable. So we both noticed Tony Kaye was absolutely in his element. And I very strongly noticed how different, what he was playing was a very different approach to Yes. And you pointed out to Flash as well. So this is much more of a US rock, as you put it, Allman Brothers or Crosby, Stills and Nash type approach. And we'll come back to that in a minute. But Tony Kaye really showing what, not that he wasn't allowed to do in Yes, but he certainly was able to take center stage and solo, I thought, in a very different way to anything that he ever did with Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, while it's nowhere near as technical as the Yes stuff, I mean, there are some challenging parts in it, but this is something more that I think that he was interested in at, you know, at this time in his life. Like he said in many interviews during that time that he was really into that whole music scene, that whole American thing, the denim jeans and stuff like that. And they had that whole style too, of the whole culture too. So he was very much into that. And you know, the thing I love about that type of music is that there's a lot of improvisation, but it's totally different. It's way more free form. It's not so, you know, totally structured. You don't have to sweat that if you don't count properly, you'll be out of rhythm with everything. You know, you could just kind of, let it go. Go with the flow, man. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, it does feel very much more like that, which is in a way, I suppose, what makes it even more fascinating that it works so well as an album. These are the first time you've heard these songs, and they don't exist, as far as I know, they don't exist in any studio version. So it's fascinating that they work so well. So some of the things I've been reading in the Will Romano book recently about some of the reasons that Bill Bruford has said that he thought he had gone as far as he could with Close to the Edge and had to leave the band then. And it's some of the things you've just been mentioning there. There was much less freedom than he wanted to have. He couldn't imagine just playing the songs as they'd been mapped out and very carefully worked out by Yes. And this music here is, as you were saying, completely different to Yes. There isn't that kind of calculating. I don't like to call it calculating, because it's just all worked out very, very precisely with Yes, isn't it? And this is where you could really cut free and enjoy yourself rather.
Yeah, I mean, the main difference that I always kind of see with this type of music is that if you're playing this song and, you know, if you're alive on stage and, you know, somebody, you know, throws a bra on stage or something and you get distracted all of a sudden, you know, you could probably afford to just look at the guy and say, okay, you know, give him a little nod and, you know, just continue playing. And then when he's ready to come back in with the verse, you just give him another nod and he's in. Whereas you can't really do that so easily with Yes stuff, you know, like if that, something like that happened, you know, they would probably panic on stage.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me as well, having grown up in the classical music tradition. It's not something, I mean, improvisation is just hardly ever rears its head in classical music. And so I understand very much the, you know, the raising of the eyebrow and the communication that you can have, particularly in something like chamber music, playing in my string quartet, which I used to do, but you never deviated from the notes on the page. So this is something really very different. I was also thinking about, though, the fact that this band, presumably through some of the connections, the big, big connections that they had to Yes themselves, were supporting Yes, but playing a very different kind of music. And I was looking through, I didn't have time to look through properly, but there's a great big long list on ForgottenYesterdays.com of all the different support bands. And we've mentioned those before, and I don't think they are all support. They're actually bands who appeared on the same bill as Yes through the years, because there are hundreds of them. And actual support bands for Yes is a different thing, I think. But if you look through those, and certainly if you think about someone like Badger, not always supported by similar kinds of acts, Yes. And I was wondering what your experience of support bands is. Do musicians tend to go for bands which are like them or in the same genre, even if you don't like those classifications in genres? But presumably, most acts go for bands to support them who sort of share something of their musical worldview.
Yeah, I definitely agree with doing that way, with getting a similar styled band in, mainly because, you know, if you bring their audience into your show,
yeah,
and they know that after their band is done, that a similar styled band is going to be on next, then chances are most of those people will probably stick around for a song or two to see how it is, and if they really enjoy it, then they'll stay for it. You know, this is, you know, and the same goes for large tours as well. Most tours that I was ever involved in, a lot of the times you would bring bands along that were of the similar genre and the similar style because you wanted to have the audiences stay throughout the entire show, right? There's nothing worse than having, you know, like a sort of a jazz fusion band mixed with a thrash band. It just never works, that sort of stuff. But that's also something that's very much of the 2000s and 1990s era, I think, because if you look back at like the 60s and 70s, there was a lot of different kind of bands playing with each other, as you mentioned. And back then, the attitude that I always seem to have read was that people were into it because it introduced them to new kinds of music and new kinds of styles. And people were much more open to it then, much more so than now.
Yeah. Well, it'll be fascinating. What do you think of the mix and the blend of music you're going to hear? And we're going to come back to that in a minute in our two pence this summer when you see Yes in more of a festival type of setup. And it's interesting, all the times I've seen Yes, I've never actually seen a support act. And the UK seems to have been pretty much left alone in terms of support acts for Yes in recent years, which is fascinating. Touring the US, of course, they've done with Toto and they've done with various others.
Just Styx. Trying to think.
Styx, yes, that's right. And also Procol Harum, didn't they? Quite recently, yeah. So it's something that they seem to do a lot more in the US and Canada and so on. So it'll be fascinating to see what you think of that. But, you know, that's not what we're talking about now. We're talking about Badger and One Live Badger. And fascinating, though, that you liked side two, essentially, or the last two songs anyway. And I actually preferred the first side, which I felt were slightly more interesting. But the two on that you mentioned, the Preacher and On the Way Home, so that they seem to have been a bit more in this sort of tradition of religious or Christian-themed bands, don't they? Because they're both on that theme. And at the end of On the Way Home, they've got a sort of sing-along chorus of you know, I'm coming, Lord, that kind of thing. And the Preacher obviously is about a Christian preacher, not something that Yes. I mean, if you think about Yes, and again in that book that I'm reading at the moment, Will Romano points out all the blend of sort of mystical and Christian and all sorts of other religions that John Anderson went in for. But this is very, very explicitly those two songs, particularly, are Christian songs. So how do you think that comes over? I mean, is that a good idea? And could that have been done a bit later on in time, I mean?
Well, I think it went over just fine. Like I said, I think back then people were a lot more accepting and, you know, willing to, you know, try new things musically to hear what people had to offer. And, you know, as far as the style of music, I mean, it's very soulful and very bluesy based. Yeah. And that's something that I really enjoy as well. I mean, I like bands like, you know, the Black Crowes, and Stevie Ray Vaughan was a huge influence on me as a guitar player as well. And they're very blues based. And even if you take a look at a band like Black Sabbath, their musical influences are steeped very deeply in traditional kind of blues, right? It's just a hell of a lot louder, right? So, but, you know, I've always liked that sort of bluesy approach. So when these songs came out on the record, I immediately took to them. But that's not to say I didn't like the whole record. I think the whole record from beginning to end is absolutely fantastic. There's not a song to be skipped, in my opinion, on this album at all. So I just think, though, that the blues, I think it works. I mean, as far as the sort of gospel-y, you know, everybody stand up and clap your hands sort of chorus at the end, I mean, maybe it might have put a few people kind of aback that it came out, but I don't think that it made any sort of negative reaction with the crowd.
No, I don't think it did. And I think, as you said, that in the late 60s, early 70s, people were rather more used to that kind of thing. And if you think about the musicals that were coming out, Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat and Jesus Christ Superstar and all those sorts of things, it was very much more in the popular conscience of the time, I think. But I was thinking about when I was young, and in the 80s, I think, you know, apart from Cliff Richard, you probably would have ended your career if you tried to include religious or particularly Christian. And I think that was more in the UK. It suddenly became, I think, in the 80s, very much more risky to say that you believed in anything. It was much more of a, I don't know what, it was much more of a, it was all about money. It was all about relying on yourself and all those other kinds of influences, particularly in music, seem to disappear. So I was fascinated to hear that in there. And if you think of another band, of course, that I'm very interested in, Queen, they started off as well, including a few bits of sort of Christian-themed songs very early on, but then you would never hear that again past this kind of time. So I'd be fascinated to hear, if anybody wants to leave a message on the show notes for this episode, what they think about that. Was there a point at which people turned against that, or did it just become not as trendy or whatever?
Well, as time went on? I do find, though, in America, it was a lot more going on. I mean, the Christian rock scene is pretty big in America right now here. Like, maybe not back then, but definitely now there's definitely a lot of Christian rock radio. And the funny thing is, I'm not sure if you remember this, Kevin, if they even broke any ground in the UK at all, but there was a band in the mid 80s called Striper that were a total Christian metal band. And they went as far as throwing out Bibles from the stage into the audience during their shows. And one of the most interesting tours I ever heard, and talk about a combination, is they had Striper and King Diamond. And King Diamond was like one of these guys who they like was deemed as like sort of a Satanist guy, right? So they would come out, and he would have his inverted cross microphone stand and stuff like that. And then he would go and do his bit. And then after, they would come out after and throw their Bibles out into the audience. So you can imagine with that cross-pollination.
Yes, absolutely. And that brings us back to our discussion of support acts and being on the same bill as other people. Yes, absolutely. And yes, I did know about Striper because I used to buy a few copies of Metal Hammer magazine in the UK, but looking for other things. So they did include things like Queen and a bit more mainstream at the time. But yes, I did. I remember distinctly a Striper front cover of the Metal Hammer magazine. So yes, I was aware of that movement. Certainly in the pop charts, that seemed to completely have disappeared by the 80s. So fascinating to hear what you can leave on our show notes for this week. Well, yeah, really enjoyed listening to that album. Brian Parrish was very impressive, as you said, and I see he's very much still active today. He's just done a concert he's promoting on his website, in fact. And yes, he's done an awful lot more music from this time up until the present day. But of course, he left the band just before really they sort of hit their sweet spot, and they changed a good number of the musicians when they did their first studio album, which we played your review of last week, Mark. But yeah, really, really enjoyed that. It is an album I would definitely recommend everybody goes and listens to, if only on YouTube, as I have been doing. I must get myself a proper copy of that album, One Live Badger. Great stuff. But for the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're welcome, Kevin.
This is Two Pence with Mark Anthony Kay and Kevin Mulrine.
So Mark is still with me for Two Pence. Hello again, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin.
So we have two pieces of news, huge news for Yes fans this week. And as I said at the top of the episode, this does include spoilers. So if you don't like setlist spoilers, look away and listen away now. Come back next week because we are going to talk about some spoilers just now. But first of all, fantastic announcement today. Well, I heard about it today anyway, and I think it was Daniel Crone that brought my attention to it first of all, and then Keith Hoisington, as usual, of course, had it on his Facebook page, which is an announcement from Yes Management. And the headline is, "Do you have any vintage Yes recordings?" And it goes on, "Towards the end of 2019, Yes will be releasing a box set of BBC sessions and early years recordings, primarily focusing on 1969 and 1970. So it's going to be an official release, and as they say, it will eclipse anything released before from this era, featuring a wealth of material that fans won't have heard already." And what they're doing is asking you to send your recordings and memorabilia and so on from that time. So it looks like they're only looking at 69, 70, to the management, and it may get included on this boxed set. So I was very excited about this. What was your reaction, Mark?
I couldn't get my wallet out quicker, I don't think. Of course, there's nothing to order yet, but I mean, if there was, then I'm sure I would have been fumbling through looking for a debit card or a credit card or something. but I really like these kinds of box sets. I always have. I mean, I've been a big supporter of it from many things. I mean, anything that Yes has put out, as far as that, these like multiple, you know, CDs yeah. and DVDs, I've always jumped on it. I'm very curious, though, to hear what they put on this, because, I mean, of late, we've been seeing quite a few emergences of video, for example, black and white video that came out of nowhere, like of performances with Peter Banks and, you know, those guys back in the day.
Yes.
And the audio from that is pretty good. I'm wondering if maybe they're going to kind of, you know, clean up some of that and use that for the audio. And I'm wondering, you know, because one thing I've noticed listening to various different podcasts that people will be talking to various archivists from different bands. And I'm wondering how many people out there have in their attics, as these people say, cassettes or reel-to-reels of old things that they've forgotten about that maybe might see the light of day now. I'm very curious because, you know, there was always that great story about that guy who went into a concert. I believe it was... just when Steve Howe joined, he brought his reel-to-reel machine into a concert, if you can believe that, and asked the sound man if he could hook up to the board. And that's where we got that fantastic set of Yes, where they did Yours and No Disgrace and a few other ones that are just phenomenal sounding because some chap came in with his two-track machine and recorded it straight from the board. So I'm wondering if there's other people out there that did, you know, various recordings back in those days, or maybe Yes. Maybe people from the crew have a recording. I'm really curious.
Yes, it's going to be absolutely fascinating to see what turns up. And maybe we think at the moment that, you know, with people like Jim Cushing that we spoke to a few weeks ago, who's put a huge amount on YouTube, and there are other bootleg collectors who release all their stuff on the internet now. But what else is out there? That's right. And it reminds me of the Doctor Who story. I think I've mentioned it before. And they lost lots of episodes, as you know, of Doctor Who over the years. Mm-hmm. And then just recently, they found some in the most unlikely places. I can't remember what the country was. It was Azerbaijan or Afghanistan or somewhere. And they went into the local radio studios there. And just underneath a desk, they found a lost episode of Doctor Who. So hopefully we will have our own Doctor Who moment with Yes and find some remarkable things. But of course, many of the people that we know on the podcast have lots of memorabilia and so on that they're looking for as well from this time, like Dave Watkinson and Keith Hoisington and many others that we know very well. So hopefully some of their stuff will be able to be included on this. So it sounds like it's going to have some kind of a multimedia aspect to it if they're looking for photographs and other memorabilia and so on. So that does sound very exciting indeed. However, I was thinking about the BBC recordings. I think those have all been released, haven't they? At least the ones I've ever heard of.
Yeah, I think the BBC stuff is probably out already. I mean, who knows, though? We could be wrong. Maybe there's something that they've kept back, or maybe there's something on a shelf somewhere, like you mentioned, that hasn't been shown yet.
Yeah.
Who knows? I mean, you never know with these sort of things.
I bet the person who knows more about this than anyone else actually is Henry Potts. So if you're listening, Henry, then do get in touch. I bet he's got some inside track on this, quite literally.
Yeah.
Okay. So the second piece of news I wanted to go on to also was, this is the spoiler. So if you don't want to hear about the set list for the US Royal Affair tour and Canada, then don't listen to this next bit. So Alan White, nice interview with Alan White, has turned up today. And again, it was Daniel, I think, Crone, who sent me the first link to this. And then I've included it on the Yes Music Podcast Facebook page as well. And confirmation that Gates of Delirium from Relayer is going to be played on the Royal Affair tour. Now, this has not been played since 2001 by the band, and that was on the symphonic tour, so it was treated in a rather different way. So this is the first time since 1976, as far as I can tell, that this has been played with an actual keyboard player, and that, of course, was Patrick Mraz, who played it in 1976. So you are rather lucky, Mark, because you're going to be able to hear this band version. So I'm assuming you're rather looking forward to that.
Oh, yeah, I'm really excited about this because, you know, there's been lots of talk about, are they going to do anything from Relayer? Are they going to do the whole album? What are they going to do? You know, and everybody is always thinking, yeah, it's just probably going to be soon. But now, not only are we going to get soon, but we're going to get everything else before it.
Yeah.
So I'm very much looking forward to that because this is going to be the first time, I believe, that we're going to hear John Davison sing this. So,
oh, yes.
I think this is going to be a great moment in Yes history, because I think that he's going to absolutely nail it, because everything that he's done so far from the Yes catalog, I found to be spot on. And, you know, in some situations, and I know I have to hide after saying this again, sometimes even better than John Anderson has done it live in some aspects. So
yeah.
I'm looking very much forward to it. And, you know, I think, you know, Billy Sherwood and them are going to get the music down very well indeed. Mm. And I'm very excited about it.
Well, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because we have heard a few rumors about different types of songs being played, and also things like the Buggles' Video Killed the Radio Star and all those sorts of things. But I really wasn't expecting this kind of major piece to have been brought out. I thought that we'd have a little bit from the 80s maybe, and a bit from the first couple of albums. But This is a major undertaking, isn't it? And actually, because their set is going to be shorter than a full Yes concert, as it were, because it's one of these festival-type events, this is going to take up quite a chunk.
Well, yeah. I mean, if I read correctly, they're doing an hour 45 because there's so many bands on the bill. And considering this is like a 20-minute song,
yeah,
you know, that's, there you go. That's quite a chunk of their set right there.
Yeah,
it is. But I mean, think about it, you know, a 20-minute song of that caliber and quality, I'll gladly sacrifice a song or two to have that on the set list. And plus, like you said, it hasn't been played in so long. You know, wouldn't it be great if they dumped, you know, See No Good People, something else in exchange of this? I mean, I'd gladly make that exchange.
Yeah. I think I would as well, because this is a major Yes event, I think. And I think there'll be a lot of fans who are really, really pleased about this. I mean, okay, it's not Sound Chaser, but it is the other side, the whole of the first side of Relayer. So it's going to be absolutely wonderful. I can't wait to hear it. And hopefully there will be a really good recording made of this. And I'm fascinated to hear how Jeff Downes particularly approaches this. And it's one of those big questions always, isn't it? How can Jeff Downes reproduce something that Patrick Mraz did originally? We shall see. And I'm very jealous that you're going to get to see that actually in person, Mark. But let us know on the show notes if you think that's a good idea to try and do Gates of Delirium live this year. If you're excited about it, I'm sure you are if you're going along to see the band. Wonderful stuff. For the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're welcome, Kevin.
Thank you. Just before we go, here's the patron update for this week. Yes Music podcast producers are Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, VR Hoisington, Bill Govier and Wayne Hall. And Yes Music podcast patrons, or at least half of them, are Mark James Lang, Mark Kelberg, Michael O'Connor, Miguel Falcao, Neil Caffrey, Paul Hales, Paul Tomei, Paul Wilson, Peter Herndon, Lobate Scarp, Rachel Hadaway, Mark Zarkol Bags, Robert Nasa, Scott Colombo, Scott Smith, Simon Barrow, Stephen Lamb, Steve Dill, Steve Perry, Steve Rode, Steve Scott, Stephen Raw, Terence Sadler, Tim Stannard, Todd Dudley, Tony Handley, Joseph Cottrell, Keith Hoisington and William Hayes. Continued thanks, of course, to Robert and David as well. So thank you very much indeed to all those patrons. If you'd like to join them in helping to support the show financially and getting access to lots of exclusive content and activities, head over to Patreon, patreon.com/YesMusicPodcast, or just click the link on yesmusicpodcast.com. So once again, that's just about all the time we have this week. I do hope we'll be back next week. But in the meantime, please do keep listening and getting involved by signing up as a patron at patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast or subscribing to the podcast via your podcatcher or web service of choice at yesmusicpodcast.com. You can always send an email to show@yesmusicpodcast.com as well. So until next week, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.